Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, first thing, we're going to be talking about water. I mean, has it rained enough this year? Will we ever see sun again? We're going to take a look at California's water supply and whether we have enough to get through the year. Then we'll be talking about public safety. It's a hot button issue this election year. And just how bad is it? We'll take a look at a new report that pins some blame on the police and examine whether newly proposed laws and ballot measures will help. Are you voting differently this year because of law and order concerns? We'll be asking for your comments and questions about the state of crime around the Bay. Send your comments to stateofthebay@kalw.org. That's stateofthebay@kalw.org. And at the end of this hour, we'll hear about edible landscaping from Marin landscape designer Christian Douglas. I'm not sure what that is, and I definitely want to hear more, so stay tuned for that. But lately, it seems that when it rains here, it really does pour. What does that mean? Does it mean that we have enough water? Janine Jones is the person who can tell us. She's the Interstate Resources Manager at the California Department of Water Resources and former chair of the Western Water States Council. Welcome to State of the Bay, Janine.
Thank you.
Well, with titles like that, I think you are the true expert on water, so I'm happy that you're here. We saw a lot of rain this past weekend in the Bay Area and up in the Sierras, as much as 10 feet of snow. So I think the big question that everybody wants to know is, are we good now? Are we out of drought territory?
Well, we are definitely in a much better place than where we were at the beginning of this winter season, because if you remember, we had a rather dry and particularly not snowy start to our season. Over the course of this weekend, we gained about more than 20 percentage points in terms of statewide snowpack, which is great. We're a little above average in precipitation, and reservoir storage is still above average, courtesy in part of the very wet year that we had last year. So we're certainly in much better shape than where we were, say, in January, for example.
So if this past weekend is maybe the last major storm that we get, what does that say for the rest of the year?
Well, we are starting to transition into more springtime conditions. So we expect to see less of these big cold storms, longer days, meaning that snowpack will begin to melt later in the season. Normally, California reaches its peak snowpack on April 1st, and we're almost there, so that's good.
Oh, that makes me feel a lot better. The snowpack provides critical storage. I think all Californians in the last few years have become very aware of, like, where does water get stored? How much do we have? But it's not just the snowpack. We have reservoirs around the state. What's that looking like in terms of how much water we have reserved?
Well, we're above average right now. As I mentioned, because of our wet season last year, we had good carryover storage going into this year. But it's also important not just to think about reservoirs, but also our groundwater, because that's a very, very important supply, especially during dry times. And over the course of our three-year drought from 2020 to 2022, groundwater basins were significantly depleted. Definitely last year's very wet conditions helped restore some of that. And this year will probably be helpful as well.
Well, I'm so interested in this idea of groundwater basins. We hear a little bit about how, the lack of groundwater is making the land kind of change in terms of its topography. When you say that these groundwater basins are being replenished, is that just rain going into the soil, or is there another way they're being replenished?
It is the surface water, whether it's rain or stream flow, going into the soil. But it's important to recognize that groundwater recovery happens much more slowly than changes in surface water storage. Also worth pointing out that some parts of the Bay Area have very little groundwater just because of the geologic conditions. Your subsurface conditions are much more rocky than they are soil. Mm-hmm. But in areas like parts of the San Jose area, for example, Santa Clara Valley, and particularly in the Central Valley, groundwater storage is very, very important.
Yeah, I would say. I mean, there's a huge new lake that emerged recently just out because of so much rain. Is that because groundwater storage was just full up?
No, that was actually too much snowmelt and rain last year. in the Tulare County area, and that is, you know, beginning to disappear now. But we'd like to see that water going underground where it can be used for future dry periods.
Often when it rains, Janine, I see comments in the paper asking, oh, all this water is just running off and it's going down the, literally down the drain. Are we doing a good job in capturing all the water that we need? Couldn't we do more to save water that comes with these storms? And I'm just curious what you think.
Well, first of all, especially for San Francisco Bay, there are environmental protection requirements for fisheries, both in the rivers draining into the bay and in the bay. So some of that water that people may say is running off into the ocean is intentionally there because of fishery needs. In other areas of the state, stormwater, increasing control and use of stormwater runoff is very significant, particularly in Southern California, where regulations have required many local agencies to really maximize stormwater discharge.
So, I mean, I grew up in California and I'm used to this, but is it okay? Can I take a longer than 3-minute shower right now, or should I still be conserving water as if a drought is about to come?
Well, you know, we talk about California transitioning to water conservation as a way of life in response to laws that were enacted in 2018. So we are still in that long-term water conservation framework. And really, we should stop thinking about droughts as an emergency and we only conserve when we have a drought or take action when we have a drought. We should be thinking about management for the long term.
Well, I think my children will be sorry to hear that because I'm constantly telling them, do not run the faucet while you're doing the dishes. So that is my pet peeve. But I'm going to admit to you, Janine, that I did take a 5-minute shower the other day. So I will try to be better. So we need to think about drought as a year-round thing, that this is just a part of our life. And as we think about water resources, where are we on desalination? I mean, do we have any plants like that in the Bay Area?
Well, you know, first of all, for different water agencies, different solutions make more or less sense depending on their individual circumstances. So desalination is one of the tools in the toolbox, as is water recycling. In other words, taking water from a wastewater treatment plant and turning it into drinking water quality and using it to recharge groundwater basins, for example. Mm-hmm. And water recycling tends to be cheaper than desalination in many areas. So that is usually the preferred choice. There are a number of small-scale inland brackish groundwater desalters, particularly in Southern California, as well as some seawater desal. But right now we have a lot more installed capacity for water recycling. And it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, we talk about thinking about drought, but really we're also thinking about transitioning to a warmer and drier climate. And that means that Mother Nature will be taking away some of the water supplies that we have historically been able to use. So we need to think about mitigating those conditions as well.
Oh, and when you say Mother Nature is going to take some water supplies away, is there anything specific in the Bay Area that you're referring to?
Well, it's basically a warmer and drier climate means there's more evaporation, mm-hmm. less of the rain that falls shows up as runoff and makes it into reservoirs. And that affects everyone in the state. And we can look at changes over decades in statewide average temperature and potential evaporation. And, you know, we can see how those impacts are playing out in watersheds across the state.
Mm. Well, you were mentioning earlier that wastewater might be used to replenish groundwater, but also wastewater is being thought of as drinking water in certain cases. I mean, treated wastewater. Is that something that we'll see a lot more in the future?
Yeah, direct potable reuse is really the next future in that area. There's been a long-standing practice with indirect potable reuse where the water is, for example, placed in a groundwater basin. But we are seeing projects moving forward that, you know, literally might put the water into a reservoir or directly into a a municipal system.
I mean, I think that the favorite headline is something to the effect of, you will be drinking your toilet water soon, which definitely gets some eyes popping. Part of the job of the Department of Water Resources is to determine water allocations around the state, who gets how much. So when the state thinks about that, does most of the water go to farming versus to urban areas or suburban areas?
Well, if you were to look at our California water plan, for example, we divide the water up into three buckets. Water that's required for the environment by regulation or statute, and then water that's used by cities and farms. The proportions fluctuate based on hydrology, wet year or dry year, but generally speaking, the ag and environment use amounts that are in the 40% range each, and urban is more like in the 15% range.
Well, we got a listener question while this segment is going, and I want to pose it to you, Janine. This listener asks, is there talk about covering the aqueduct system with solar panels to prevent evaporation and generate electricity at the same time?
Actually, there is a first-of-the-kind research project of that nature going on now in California, and that is specifically for a system in the San Joaquin Valley. And some of the things you have to think about are, you know, can people still do the maintenance on the canal that they need to be able to do with the solar panels in place? And, you know, how much will it produce and so forth? But this is a first-time research project with University of California and Water Agency to see how that goes. But certainly it's something that's been talked about in the past.
I love that here in California we're figuring out how to do it. One last question in the last 40 seconds that we have. What could I do personally to help move the needle in terms of water preservation?
Well, actually, I would reframe that question a little bit and say, what can you do personally to support the response to a warming and drying climate? And a lot of that is that we are going to need to invest in different infrastructure than we have now because, for example, we're losing the snowpack storage that we have in the Sierra and Cascade Mountains. So we encourage people to be supportive of their water agency's efforts to invest in new infrastructure and move forward with things that will help us in the long term.
That is a great piece of advice. Janine Jones, thank you so much for joining us here on State of the Bay.
It was a pleasure.
Janine Jones is with the California Department of Water Resources. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about a greater focus on law and order in this year's election. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Jay Boogie. Did you know that KALW has a newsletter that's all about music? Hear about new releases, local artists, the shows we're presenting, DJ favorites, and what's happening in the Bay. You'll be the first to learn about ticket giveaways and so much more. Subscribe by going to kalw.org/newsletter.
This week in This American Life. For months, we've been talking to Youssef. It was the same questions running through his head all the time about the same people.
What about Hadid? What about Hiba? What about Salsabil? What about my wife and the children, my mother?
Youssef is moving his family from one place to another in Gaza. Now his youngest sister is about to have a baby, and everybody may need to move again. And they're all looking to Youssef to find one more place to live. That's this week.
This American Life, tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Voters have said that top of their lists of issues this year is crime. It's an issue that's bringing voters to the polls, even with this anemic turnout. New legislation and ballot measures are being introduced, and many political leaders and organizations are trying to address these concerns. There's even yet another recall effort of Governor Gavin Newsom, partly because of his response to crime. We want you to be part of this next conversation. Curious if you're voting differently way this year because of concerns around crime? Or have you had an experience with a crime that you'd like to share? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So what we're talking about with our guests tonight is whether California and the Bay Area more specifically, are we veering towards a law and order approach when it comes to public safety? And I have a bang up all-star panel to help us talk about that. We've got Emily Hovind. She's an opinion columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. She covers state politics and policy. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. And also Magnus Lofstrom. He's the policy director of criminal justice and a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, also known as PPIC. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Magnus.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. And finally, we have Mike Mayles, a senior research fellow at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, pleasure to have you. Emily, I want to start with you. Tomorrow is the primary. And for listeners out there, if you haven't voted, there's still time. You can go to the polls or just to have your ballot stamped by tomorrow. But there's a steady drumbeat in public opinion, and that has been that parts of the Bay Area just feel less safe, whether that's because of car thefts or retail crime. I mean, honestly, between local news and next door, it just feels like perhaps it's not surprising that people feel a little less safe. How have those concerns influenced what's on the ballot?
I think to a very large degree, especially here in San Francisco. I mean, we're seeing several ballot measures that are focused on public safety in one way or another. You have two measures put on the ballot by Mayor London Breed. One of them would expand the police's power to chase after suspects who commit so-called violent misdemeanors, also allow them to deploy more types of surveillance technologies. And then another that's not directly related to crime, but I think in many voters' minds is connected, which would require adult recipients of county welfare benefits to go through a drug screening process, and then if they are found to be using illegal drugs, to take treatment in order to continue receiving those benefits. And I think even to a certain extent at the state level, we're seeing that there's a statewide ballot measure, Proposition 1, that would basically change the way that counties are spending mental health money and also allocate billions of dollars to building behavioral health facilities. Again, this includes more locked and structured facilities that we, I think, tend to associate with people who are out committing crimes on the street who may be violent and mentally ill. And then I think we're also just seeing a larger just sort of vibe surrounding this, whether it's the Democratic County Central Committee in San Francisco, that's the local Democratic Party. There's a sort of more moderate criminal justice focused slate and a more progressive state slate. And then this is going to continue playing into just how voters are electing people. And I think in the mayor's race in November for mayor of San Francisco, that's going to be a huge deal. It's just really interesting to see.
So crime seems to be motivating people. And yet I'm hearing that the turnout is so poor. Do people expect more voters to turn in absentee ballots tomorrow or show up at the polls to make their statement about this?
I think it's really interesting because we're seeing that crime and public safety are motivating perhaps a certain sector of the electorate. And so far, as in many primary elections, especially earlier ones, we're seeing older and typically more conservative voters be the ones to turn in their ballots. And so I think whatever does end up happening right now, we're potentially on track to have the lowest turnout in a primary election in California history. And so whatever does happen, those results are going to be determined by, you know, only a certain segment of the voting populace. But then I think to another degree, I mean, if the folks do not like some of the policies that are being proposed and being put on the ballot, you need to voice that by voting. And if you do support them, you need to get out there and vote. And so I think either way, you need to be motivated to get out there because these policies are being shaped directly by you.
Yeah. Mike, I wanted to turn to you because your organization put out a study recently that suggests when it comes to crime, it may be that the police are the issue themselves. Tell us a little bit about that study, which focused on something called clearance rates. What are those and why do they matter?
Well, the clearance rate is the rate at which police solve crimes. And it's the percentage of each reported Part 1 crime that police clear by an arrest, solved by an arrest. And it's their own measure and their own statistics that we used in this report. And what we found is that in one sense, people are right to feel less safe. And it's not because crime is up. Actually, in 2023, the latest figures we have is that California crime rates are at their lowest level, third lowest level ever recorded in the last 60 years. So actually, we're going through a real downturn in crime, actual crime. But where people are maybe feeling a little uneasy is the fact that they don't feel like people are being held who commit crimes are being held accountable for them. And the reason is not liberal prosecutors or reforms in state laws, but the fact that the police make dramatically fewer arrests per reported offense today and per officer on the street than they did 30, 40 years ago. And that's really the reason people are feeling less safe. And let me just give you one figure here, two figures here. In 1990, police cleared 22% of all crimes reported to them, which is really pretty good, given that crimes are hard to solve. And they made 32 arrests per officer on the street. Today, police clear only 13 to 14% of all crimes reported to them, and they only make 10 arrests for every officer on the street, despite the fact that they have dramatically fewer crimes reported to them. So I think that's maybe why people are feeling uneasy.
And are those statistics statewide, or and tell us what the statistics look like for the Bay Area?
Well, in San Francisco and Oakland particularly, they're among the lowest crime clearance rates in the state. And there is you're going to, I think, have a statement here from the San Francisco Police Department, which I'd like to get into. But, yeah, we have a very low clearance rate here. We have very low arrest rates per officer. There are some reasons for that, and we should probably talk about those.
Well, no, just to be clear, a clearance rate is the rate at which a crime, an arrest happens, or that a conviction happens?
It's at the rate at which an arrest happens. So if the individual is later acquitted of the crime, that doesn't reduce the clearance rate. Clearance rate is basically based on police arrests and perceptions they solve the crime.
Well, as you pointed out, San Francisco Police, the department sent us a response, and they say that they have an 85% clearance rate for homicides in 2023. San Francisco has long been challenged with auto burglaries, which are a serial crime that typically have around a 2% clearance rate. Therefore, our overall clearance rates are significantly diminished due to one category of crime. Head of communications, the communications director of strategic communications, Evan Sternofsky, also says, most people, I would hope, do not think auto break-ins and homicides are equivalent. San Francisco has seen steep decreases in violent crime over the last 15 years, thanks to the hardworking members of the SFPD. In 2019, homicides reached their lowest point since 1963. And he goes on to say that, you know, your report doesn't have scientific merit. So I want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, let's take the very small part of that that's true. First of all, San Francisco Police Department does have an exemplary record of solving homicides, and that's been fairly consistent over the years. So let's give them some credit where they're due. They do solve murder, and murder is a very serious crime. So congratulations for that. They are also correct that auto burglaries are hard to solve, and that's one of the reasons Oakland and San Francisco Police Departments both have very low rates, but it's only a small part of the reason. The San Francisco Police Department also has lower than average crime rates for robbery or crime clearance rates for robbery, rape, assault, motor vehicle theft, and only an average clearance rate for burglary. So even if you exclude larceny, the San Francisco Police Department ranks in the bottom 20% of law enforcement agencies statewide in solving crimes. So like I said, even if you exclude auto break-ins, which are hard to solve, San Francisco Police Department still is not doing very well, especially for the amount of money it's getting. So, the parts of the statement are true, and I'm sorry, most of it is not.
Mm. Well, Emily, you know, you were saying earlier about the efforts that politicians are putting in to bring law and order, and here's this study that says, well, you know, maybe adding more money to the police department budget isn't your solution. Is that something that's politically palatable at this moment?
Well, we're seeing a fight over how much should be paid to police and how much money the department should have on the ballot as well. There's Proposition B, which was originally going to set a minimum staffing level for the SFPD and also require, you know, a certain amount of money be set aside for their budget to hire more officers, retain officers, hiring bonuses, things of that nature. Then the measure kind of got changed, and now it's been made contingent on a future or amended tax to sort of bring in new revenue to fund that. And so opponents are saying it was hijacked and it's a cop tax, because why should we have to raise taxes to pay for a basic public service? And then, you know, others are saying, well, why should we just keep giving money to SFPD for a lot of different reasons? And I think at the end of the day, what's really fascinating about this is that currently, San Francisco is spending a lot of money on police overtime. And part of the reason for that is that they don't have enough police officers by a lot of different measures and studies kind of looking at that. And so I think it's we really do need to look at, why are there not enough police officers? Is assigning bonus the way to do it, or is that really not going to solve the problem? You know, how long are officers staying once they're hired? Do we have accurate and good ways of measuring what retains them? And, you know, I think that's going to be a really big part of it. And then also streamlining the hiring process. I know that at some points in time, it was taking upwards of a year to hire a police officer in San Francisco. And that doesn't make any sense, because who's going to wait around for a year to get a new job, right? And so I think there are ways that we can address this problem that maybe are more policy oriented and less political. But I think that this problem does become very political, because an easier solution is to just, you know, propose giving money to the problem in various different ways, rather than actually looking at the current system and ways within it that could be augmented to better solve the problem. But I do think that it is very clear and very true that we do need more police, and I'm sure there are ways to make their internal processes more effective and more efficient. But we do need more police, and there's a way, I think, to have them at the same cost or lower than what we currently have.
This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing one of the hot button issues of this election year, which is crime. We're joined by Evely Hoven, opinion columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle, Mike Males of the Center of Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and I'm going to bring in Magnus Lofstrom of the Public Policy Institute of California. Curious listeners, have you been a recent victim of crime, or a small business owner who's dealt with retail theft? What do you think needs to change, if anything, to make the Bay Area safer? You can join us by emailing us at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Magnus, I wanted to turn to you because one of the things that makes people, I think, feel that crime is on the rise is they walk into their Walgreens or their CVS. Things are not just locked up, but they're behind glass. And, you know, there's some stores that are putting barriers to exit so that people won't run out with items. So is this feeling that is retail theft up, or is that just optics?
It depends on where you are. It's like, you know, crime in general is local.
Yeah.
You know, it's there are areas where we're seeing notable increases in retail theft, and the Bay Area is actually one of those areas. So we have seen in terms of shoplifting over the last few years in the Bay Area, seen some increases in the Central Valley. Also, if we expand it to look at commercial burglary, just to capture higher value retail theft, then we're seeing broader increases in urban areas. So, yes, there are the data is pointing towards some increases there. But I think it's also, and I think San Francisco is a very interesting place to look at retail theft, because it's been in media. It's received headlines. And we saw big increases. We saw big increases in the, if we look at shoplifting, for example, we saw a steep increase around the mid-2021 that lasted for about 1 year. And then it dropped dramatically. And it dropped down to levels that we had before the pandemic as well. And then when we fast forward, we look at commercial burglary, it stayed up, through 2022. But when we start to look at 2023 data and break it down by month, it's actually looking pretty good encouraging in San Francisco. We're actually seeing decreases in property crime. And where they were at the end, especially in the second half of 2023, they were below of the values and the numbers that we saw before the pandemic started. So there's some encouraging news at this side of the Bay, not so much on the other side in Oakland, for example, where we continue to see increases in both violent and property crime. Retail theft, commercial burglary in Oakland continues to increase quite notably.
I wonder, Magnus, is there is part of the data maybe people not reporting the crime, or do you account for that at all? Because, you know, again, going to next door, you hear people say, I just got this, my bike was stolen, or my this was stolen. I didn't bother to report it because the police are not going to be able to find it.
I think when we're looking at property crime in general, with the exception of auto theft, It's underreported. We don't report all of those incidents. Auto theft is different because we have an insurance incentive to report it to law enforcement. So that is, we have pretty complete reporting on that. So when we look at retail theft, especially what we capture in the crime data under shoplifting, it tends to be, we believe it's here in California, it's the lower value property theft. That's where we would expect underreporting to be especially troublesome. Mm. So it's possible. I think that when we're looking at the data and trying to understand trends, what we worry about is, are there changes to underreporting? Are people less likely to report these incidents or not, or more likely at any particular point in time? That's what makes it more difficult to determine whether we are seeing increases or not. And we certainly have heard concerns that reporting has decreased, that exactly for the reasons that you're saying. But unfortunately, there's no way to look at the data to say to what extent that's true, because we don't have complete numbers. Retailers aren't giving us data and information about, you know, all the incidents that they are aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much, Mike, does the fact that, you know, a crime goes underreported affect what you've been talking about? I mean, if people aren't telling the police that this thing was stolen, I mean, does that affect the clearance rates that you've been examining?
Well, it would probably improve the clearance rates, if anything, because the reported crimes are the ones that people think might be solved. So, yeah, if we reported every single crime, property and otherwise, then the clearance rates would probably go down even more. So we've had this problem, though, ever since there's been crime. Is underreporting has been a serious problem, and it's revealed every year in the National Crime Victimization Survey that shows that, as Magnus said, that people underreport crimes, and they do it every year, and they have for decades. So, yeah, that's a problem for law enforcement. And the Sacramento sheriff, for one, just lambasted some of the big retailers in Sacramento for not reporting shoplifting even when they know about it. Mm-hmm. We can't solve crimes that are not reported. Well, so, yeah, that's a point.
Let's go to the phones. We have Hannah from Richmond joining us here on State of the Bay. Hi, Hannah. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I have a shop called Contact Records in Oakland, California, and we're actually in Temescal Alley where there was a slew of burglaries last, I guess it was early Friday morning. And I don't know, there was a lot of reporters that came around, a lot of people saying, oh, we need more cops, we need more beat cops patrolling, like people don't feel safe. And it's true that I think in general people, and it's kind of frustrating that people say they don't feel safe. You know, cars get broken into regularly outside of our store, including my own. It's just always kind of like, oh, you never know if your window will be broken. And I guess my perspective is that if there was more support for people to just live, like if we had better access to healthcare and affordable food, and there wasn't this incredible class divide between people making tech wages at companies that get huge tax breaks versus people that just work everyday jobs, like we might not have these problems. And another thing I just want to point out is that small business owners pay an exorbitant amount of taxes. We just shell out money like crazy. Like it's almost impossible to have it be your only job. And I feel like the city could support us more by feeling like those tax dollars are going towards a better quality of life for everyone. I just think that the Bay Area in general, I grew up in San Francisco, and I've just seen the city get turned over to millionaires, basically, that these companies get huge tax cuts. Meanwhile, There's people just, you know, like that I grew up with that have been on the streets for like 18 years. And it's just a real, you know, people are just desperate. People aren't bad people. That's not why they're committing crimes. They're committing crimes because they don't have access to basic human needs.
These are really good points, Hannah, and thank you for calling. You're a remarkably tolerant small business owner who's been subjected to crime and, I mean, generous in that way. Emily, are there any measures on the ballot or, you know, happening right now that are going to help people like Hannah, small business owners who are paying, as Hannah said, lots of taxes to the county of Alameda, probably to the city of Oakland, who just want the quality of life to improve?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And Hannah, thank you for sharing your experience. I think something that you highlighted that really struck with me was just the fact that you are paying so much money in taxes going back to the community, but you're not seeing that translate into tangible improvements for people in the community. And I think that really points to a failure of government, you know, whether that is corruption or mismanagement or poor communication or inefficiency or whatever it may be. I think that's part of the reason why we are having all of these very intensified conversations surrounding public safety is so many residents feel fed up because they are doing their part. They are paying into the system, but they're not seeing the system deliver the results that were promised. And many people are languishing on the streets. Many people are, you know, stealing to survive in addition to some of the more, you know, organized retail theft where they are knowingly going out and, you know, trying to commit these crimes. But, you know, as to whether there are measures on the ballot, I don't think there's anything on the ballot that's going to, you know, directly necessarily help small business owners. I think it also depends to a certain extent on your view on these issues. And I know there are some small business owners in San Francisco that are supportive of you know, some of the tougher on crime measures because they are tired of having their business broken into or having people, you know, sitting outside the front door using drugs and things like that and, you know, preventing customers from entering. So it'll be really interesting, but I just really want to emphasize that I think the point she made about sort of government incompetence and inefficiency is kind of fueling a lot of this distrust and discontent around the policies that we're experiencing.
And Mike, I want to take that question also to you. I mean, you're with the Center of Juvenile and Criminal Justice. I mean, here's Hannah, who's trying to have a broad horizon or perspective on the crimes that are happening on her block in front of her business. Your study is saying that more money to the police isn't necessarily the answer. Do you have another approach that you think would be better?
Well, I agree completely with the point of view that more supportive healthcare systems and more supportive economic systems are essential to reducing the crime that is committed by people who commit it out of need. And, you know, that's a good point. It was made very well already. There's another segment of crime that I would be interested in any research that's been done on that. And that's what have we seen a shift toward more organized retail theft, particularly in the areas of shoplifting and auto break-ins that involve organized groups more than they involve the individuals of the past that were just, you know, having a lot of personal problems and a lot of economic problems and had to steal to stay alive. I'd like to know a little more about that because we've seen a massive decline in crime by young people in California, 80-90%. I mean, it's massive over the last 30 years. And it really indicates that the kinds of shopliftings and retail burglaries and auto break-ins we're seeing today may have shifted more toward organized groups that go from area to area.
Hmm. Well, Magnus, I mean, you're a retail theft specialist tonight. I mean, what's your take on that? Is it organized crime?
We don't know. It's a short answer. We really don't know. And this is one of the challenges. We are like they're looking at very different policy solution depending on what's behind it. To what extent are we seeing these types of crimes from that are acts out of desperation and poverty as opposed to organized crime rings? And so that's a big challenge there. There's no doubt about that.
Well, a lot of what you hear about, Magnus, in this conversation is Prop 47. This is Prop 47's fault. And just to remind people, that was a proposition passed 10 years ago, and it changed lower-level crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. And now $950 is the threshold for felonies. Have you found any data to say that Prop 47 is correlated to an increase in crime?
We've done work trying, we evaluated the impacts of Prop 47 on crime. We found no evidence that violent crime went up as a result of Prop 47, but we did find evidence that some property crime did go up as a result of Prop 47, and those are the two types of crimes we were talking about here. Car break-ins went up as a result. We also found some evidence that shoplifting went up in the first year in the wake of Prop 47, but then it came back down to the pre-Prop 47 level in 2 years after. And we don't know if that was because those incidents actually decreased or the reporting changed. So there is some evidence in those immediate years that some crime went up as a result. To what extent that's playing out now, I mean, this is 10 years later, it's hard to tell. There's so many changes that we've seen to the criminal justice system and just broadly to society over those 10 years. So it's really hard to tell. I think, you know, part of this, when we're talking about crime in general, we're talking about police and policing as well, as I don't think it's just the budget side we want to look at. One thing that has happened is, yeah, we're spending more money on police, but there are fewer police officers. We actually have now fewer police officers in California than we have had going back to at least 1992. That's the earliest data that we have when we make adjustment for the population. We've seen a drop in the number of police officers in just the last couple of years, about 3,600. And that's truly relevant. We're talking about clearance rate, and I think that's an important measure of police performance, but it's not the only measure. When I think about policing and the impact that has in terms of reducing crime, it's on the deterrence side. So clearance rate is dealing with reactive policing. It's what you do when there is a crime that's been reported. The deterrence side is the proactive side. What are police doing to prevent crime from happening, to prevent there from being a victim? And that's an important part when we're thinking about police. And that's where the research is showing that it has a big deterrent effect, especially when it comes to violent crime. Maybe not so much for property crime, but certainly for violent crime. So that's another way to think about this issue of police and policing in the context of crime.
Such good food for thought. Emily, I'm going to end with you. So tomorrow's the election. What story are you looking out for to kind of illuminate how people are thinking about crime? What are you kind of looking out for?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm definitely going to be looking at how San Francisco voters are handling Props E and F. Those are the ones to give the police more power, and then also to screen county welfare recipients for drug use. I'm going to be looking at Prop B. Are they voting for that kind of confusing police related measure? And then also for the Democratic County Central Committee, which is a very obscure race, but essentially determines the control of the local Democratic Party. And I think, you know, if voters pass E and F, knock down B, and, you know, elect a moderate sort of slate of DCCC candidates, right now there's a progressive majority, I think that would be a very strong signal that San Francisco is swinging more towards the political center. And if not, then they're not. And all of these narratives have been overblown.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us, Magnus Lofstrom. He's of the Public Policy Institute of California, Emily Hoven from the San Francisco Chronicle, and Mike Mails for the Center of Juvenile and Criminal Justice. That was a really satisfying conversation. Thank you so much. And coming up after the break, we'll talk to award-winning landscape designer Christian Douglas about what to plant this spring in a food-forward garden. We'll be right back.
On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll continue our March 5th primary coverage by discussing Senate candidates' environmental report cards. Then we'll look at the California Environmental Voters Climate Scorecard, which grades every state legislator and the governor on their environmental actions from the past year. What do politicians' records reveal as the state grapples with worsening wildfires, drought, extreme weather, and pollution? Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
And that will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that's happening next at 7 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, the Bay Area.
Christian Douglas, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, Ethan. Thanks so much for having me here.
Christian, you're well known for integrating food, fruits, and vegetables into what are quite beautiful landscape designs with flowers and plants that we would maybe more typically see in urban or suburban settings. So I'm wondering if you could tell us first just what drew you to landscape design and how did growing food become such a big part of that?
Yeah, I had a landscape design and fine gardening business in England for many years. It's still going now. We worked on country houses, London townhouses, very classical design. And I was there for many years and worked on some wonderful projects and learned my skills. And then I headed off for multiple years studying regenerative agriculture, permaculture, natural building. I was just looking for a little bit more and seeing if there were other opportunities to integrate with conventional design in a way that can produce more than just the visuals of a beautiful ornamental space. So I did that for many years and then ended up coming to the Bay Area and setting up two companies, one based in farming and education and the other in landscape architecture and design.
Yeah, and what brought you to the Bay Area and specifically to Marin County?
A lot of people I met, funny enough, on my travels all around the world, unsurprisingly, there are a lot of people from the Bay Area there, big travelers from here. And there's always been a big progressive movement in food production and also design. So naturally, those are my two interests. And a lot of my community were from here that I met. And I came here and then set up the company in Marin County.
So when you say regenerative agriculture, how would you explain that to listeners?
Yeah, I think regenerative agriculture is just taking more responsibility for the land, for the inputs we use, for bettering the land that we're growing on and producing more food rather than just extractive and taking away. So year on year, your space, your farm, your soil actually improves the more you farm it rather than the current methods, which is more extractive and actually depletes and requires more inputs year on year. So we're working here on a residential scale. This is more about improving soil, planting habitat species, so creating ecosystems and ecologies that can support the growing of food.
And I understand that in addition to your landscape design firm, you also have a business called Backyard Farm. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, we have two businesses. We work together. We have a team of former professional farmers. We support families to grow food. We do that via on-site consultations, online classes. And then we have the design company, which is more master planning. So taking residential and commercial properties and designing landscapes that include food and habitat species and all of those good things that we expect from a landscape.
And this is an appropriate time to have you on because now that it's March, we've had a fair amount of rain this winter, this weekend. And I know many Bay Area gardeners are really itching to get out and start their gardens and are looking at all the different offerings at local nurseries. I'm wondering if you could talk about the kinds of fruits and vegetables that you would recommend that do particularly well in Bay Area gardens.
Oh my gosh. Yes. There are so many things that we can grow in the Bay Area. Hence why it's just such a fun place to experiment and grow. At the moment, of course, everyone's going to be getting very excited because, as you said, the nurseries are filling up. I mean, frankly, you know, the Bay Area is all about microclimates. So it really depends exactly where you are. You could be a little colder on the coastal areas or you could be hotter inland. So it's just really picking things that are going to do well in your area. Typically, we have a decent prolonged heat no matter where. So any of those tomatoes, I love winter squash. They take a while to grow on the vine, but then you can store them for months in the winter. That's a big favorite of mine. And then people are now getting excited about all the fruits that are coming out. So blueberries, good time to plant blueberries, strawberries, all the cane fruits. So we have all these thornless blackberry varieties now. Really fun. Grow on a fence, grow on a pergola. Easy to grow and fruit for most of the summer. And then, of course, all of your culinary herbs, your basil, all of your pesto this summer. So there's lots and lots of things, along with all the fruit trees, the figs, pomegranates. It just depends on your space and time. But now is the time for all of that. Now we've warmed up a little bit and the buds are breaking. So I encourage people to start small to begin with. It's good just to pace yourself. Take your time. Don't get burnt out and then just build on those successes.
And I'm wondering about the ecosystem impacts of planting some of these fruits and vegetables. Do they draw, you know, beneficial wildlife? And what about the not so beneficial, you know, thinking rodents, for example, that maybe, or deer that we don't want to welcome in. What do you suggest about that? And what do you see as the impacts?
I was out this morning seeing my first California poppy, and I looked in and it was just, the bee was just romping around in there. So it's a good sign. You know, now some of our early fruits, our plums, stone fruits are starting to come into blossom. So they love bees coming in and pollinating them. So really planting more habitat that encourages hummingbirds, butterflies, bees, all the pollinators is only of benefit. Of course, here in the Bay Area, a lot of deer pressure. So fencing is good for that. But what's becoming more popular now are these wooden cages over raised planters that a lot of people are building to protect from rats and also birds. Rats became really bad during the pandemic. And those more permanent cages work really, really well.
And for people who are maybe just starting out thinking about incorporating food, I mean, you recommended that they go slow, but if you already have a bunch of perennials in your backyard, what are there certain fruits and vegetables that you would recommend that work really well, maybe with established landscape gardens?
Yeah, definitely. If you're looking at an ornamental plant, we call them edible swaps. So for instance, you might be looking to put a hedge in, but switching your hedge from a privet hedge to a culinary bay hedge, or you're looking for a sort of border plant, switching a geranium for a strawberry is a great one, a wisteria. You could switch for edible grapes. So those are all good options for a landscape that's already installed and looking for some upgrades. And then there are lots of other fun things. African blue basil, cannot go wrong with that one. And then agastache, which is also a tea species, brilliant for the hummingbirds. They love that. And any of the salvias, the native salvias are wonderful as well. They play really nicely with the food.
And of course, for a lot of people, having a food garden is just an optional thing, but food prices are at all-time highs right now. For a lot of lower-income people, backyard gardening is a way to help save costs as food prices go up. And wondering if you could maybe offer suggestions. What's the biggest bang for your buck? You know, if you're looking to save money on your grocery bill.
That's a great question, Ethan. Yeah, there's lots of different ways to work food into even a balcony. We actually really love these fabric planters. You can put these fabric planters. They're fairly inexpensive. They're about 15 gallons. You just buy some bags of compost. You can put them on a deck patio. You know, you can grow a lot of food in there. So you could even grow a sungold tomato, which produces pounds and pounds of fruit. So looking for those species that really are fairly inexpensive. You might spend $5 on a plant that's going to produce dozens and dozens of pounds of food over 3 months. Any salad greens, very quick and easy. Seed is very cheap. You could do your arugula or your salad greens. They'll be producing every 30 days. And you can just be, you know, cutting those and harvesting them like constantly for a very small initial startup cost. So I think going into more vegetables on a lower budget is a wise investment and something that will just keep returning constantly. And in this Bay Area weather, it goes on for months and months. So I think that's a great option. And we have some wonderful nurseries here. I mean, Annie's Annuals in Richmond is just fantastic. So anyone who hasn't been there yet should absolutely pay a visit. Incredibly skilled and knowledgeable employees and a huge inventory of plants that run the gamut. So that's a fun weekend trip.
That's a great recommendation for our listeners. I'll have to check that out. And before I let you go, I have to ask you about a new book that you have coming out.
That's right. Yeah, we have a book coming out in October, The Food Forward Garden. It's a book of some of the beautiful projects we've worked on, explaining to people how to add food into their landscape in this very beautiful, deliberate way. We have a whole section on how to grow food as well, just to get people excited and inspired to grow more food at home themselves.
Well, we'll have to have you back on once the book comes out. Congratulations in advance on that.
Thank you.
Thank you for just inspiring us to get outside and do some work in our gardens and grow some food. It's Christian Douglas. Thanks so much for being on State of the Bay.
Thanks, Ethan.
And to see some of the beautiful edible landscapes Christian Douglas has created, follow the link on our State of the Bay website.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we continue our climate series and talk about whether divesting from fossil fuels is an effective way to fight climate change. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments, you know where to reach us, stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. A replay of today's Your Call is next. I'm Grace Wan. Please make sure you vote tomorrow, and good night. Thanks for listening.